Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature. I'm John Pemble. To amend the state constitution, a resolution must be approved by two consecutive general assemblies and then approved by Iowa voters. But before that can happen, the Secretary of State must publish the amendment in newspapers.
I'm truly sorry.
Secretary of State Paul Pate failed to do that for two amendments that passed during the last general assembly.
I want to take this opportunity to express my sincere regrets and apologies for the bureaucratic oversight in my office that resulted in a setback in making the right to keep and bear arms part of the Iowa Constitution.
Secretary Pate reads a letter he wrote to the Iowa Firearms Coalition because one of those amendments that would insert language about firearm rights into the Constitution has to start the process over.
It's just really frustrating for our members to have to start over again.
Republican House Majority Leader Chris Hagenow says he doesn't like having the Secretary of State involved in this process.
I don't think it was ever intended that the Secretary of State should have what is in essence a pocket veto, the ability to negate the work of the legislature.
Pate is a longtime firearms supporter and says he wasn't trying to derail the resolution. He also says he does not want to stop another amendment clarifying the gubernatorial line of succession. But because of his error, this resolution must also start over.
This passed the Senate, the final passage, April 17th. It passed 35-11.
Republican Senator Robbie Smith chairs a three-member state government subcommittee. He gives the history about this line of succession amendment that passed last year.
It was passed the House due to a bureaucratic oversight in the Secretary of State's office. It was not published in newspaper. That's why we're back to step one of two or step two of three, however somebody wants to clarify it.
In 1988, the Constitution was amended, allowing the governor and lieutenant governor to be elected on the same ticket. Attorney Pete McRoberts is a lobbyist. He represents 17 clients, including the ACLU of Iowa. McRoberts is at the subcommittee not as a lobbyist, but as a lawyer who has volunteered to write some of the language in this amendment. McRoberts says this will correct issues originating with the changes made in 1988 about vacancies.
So the vacancy clause in the Iowa Constitution simply states in plain terms that unless the law says otherwise, a governor appoints a vacancy to an executive office for a prescribed period of time.
The 1988 change states a vacancy for the office of lieutenant governor requires a special election, but that was removed 20 years later. In 2017, Kim Reynolds vacated the office of lieutenant governor to become governor. When she appointed Adam Gregg to be the new lieutenant governor, the Iowa Attorney General pointed out a problem. David Ranch from the Attorney General's office explains.
Under those circumstances, the lieutenant governor who becomes governor is not constitutionally permitted to select a new lieutenant governor. And in other words, there is a process set forth in the Constitution that essentially created a line of steps down which you would go if that person then became unable or unwilling to continue as governor.
If Governor Reynolds had left office while governor, it would have led to a simultaneous vacancy since Adam Gregg was the acting lieutenant governor. In this scenario, president of the Senate would have become the governor, who for a time was Jack Whitfer and then later Charles Schneider. Attorney Pete McRoberts says a scenario like we saw in the last 2 years is rare, but this amendment will ensure a clearer process to the line of succession if it happens again.
It's a thing which maybe none of us will need to see again in our lifetimes, but it happens frequently enough that the fact that you're hitting it now when you don't need to speaks well.
McRoberts says in the past 60 years, three governors have vacated their office before their terms ended. Senator Robbie Smith compares this constitutional amendment to insurance.
When you buy insurance, you hope you never have to use it. This is something that's insurance that we're putting in the state constitution. I hope we never have to use it. But the clear thing, it is there for when we need it or the next generation needs it.
The three-member panel signs the resolution. Senator Smith says it is the same language as was approved last year. However, there is a new section he plans to add when it reaches the full state government committee. The second section would expand where the constitutional amendments are published, which right now the only requirement is in a newspaper.
We want to make sure that the public is informed of it. back 100 years ago where you had newspapers, yeah, that was probably the best way to put it in there. I think we could have a component to where we still have newspapers, but also put it online and be that be the major part of it, is to have it online. That way people can see it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we could have it on there for 5 years leading up to the vote.
Smith also does not want the responsibility of publishing to fall to the Secretary of State.
Well, I think maybe we want to look at LSA, Legislative Service Agency, and empower them to do it. They're nonpartisan, and we'll put in there that they shall put it online and put it in newspapers on that. Currently, we have a Secretary of State. I'm not saying this one did that. I'm just saying in general, I want to be clear on that. A Secretary of State could have a de facto pocket veto, and that's something that I don't think anybody thought could happen when this law was created a number of decades ago, and I think we need to come in and clarify that.
If this resolution passes the full committee, it will be debated in the Senate. That debate can happen this year or in 2020 during the second half of this, the 88th Iowa General Assembly. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's weekly legislative podcast, Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble. In a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee, Republican Chair Jason Schultz opens the floor for public input on a bill that would remove the requirement to have a permit to carry a handgun or a pistol.
I do not see this as a weapons bill. I don't see it as a gun control or anti-gun control. It's a people control bill.
A person can still get a permit to carry, but it would be optional. Schultz says people who won't break the law, like him, are being regulated under the requirement to have a gun permit.
I've gone through the system. I was never going to hurt anybody, and yet I'm the one who has to go through through an intrusive process. Those who are going to use weapons to harm somebody else are obviously going to skip this procedure, carry anyway, do as they want. So I don't see why it would be in Iowa's best interest to have government regulate the law abiding and not have any way to regulate the law breaker. So I'm going to speak up for the law abiding citizen who wants to be able to carry a weapon without asking permission from their own state government.
14 other states have passed a similar law. It's also known as constitutional carry, allowing a pistol to be carried by a person, whether it's concealed or not. Many provide testimony at this subcommittee. National Rifle Association lobbyist Scott Jones says the NRA supports a person's choice to use a gun for self-defense.
Self-defense situations are difficult, if not impossible, to anticipate, and law-abiding citizens should not be required to pay government-mandated fees and navigate a licensing system in order to exercise a fundamental individual right.
Connie Ryan from the Interfaith Alliance says guns are at the heart of placing communities in danger.
There's logic that require us to have permits. And with all due respect to the gentleman who spoke before, the government does have a role in making sure that to the best of its ability, we keep our people safe. And so there is a purpose to having permits and for the government to know who has is carrying a weapon and who is not.
Jim Hirschberg from Lorville begins to cite laws going back to the 19th century.
In 1872, there was a law passed making it a crime on Sunday the Sabbath to carry a gun, or hunt, or work, or dance, or horse race, or sell property, if the action may disturb any worshiping assembly or private family.
As he outlines Iowa's early gun history, Hirschberg says the issuing of gun permits was arbitrary.
The sheriff's buddies were sure to be able to carry a gun, but not any undesirables. Iowa's permit system to carry is a holdover from Jim Crow laws designed to discriminate. With the change in Iowa's concealed carry system a few years back, from May issue to shall issue, it took away the sheriff's arbitrary power to determine who may or may not have the ability to defend himself. This change eliminated the taint of racism, but not the repugnant infringement of the human right of one to defend themselves.
Is a permit really such an onerous thing to be able to carry something that can kill someone else?
Jane Robinette from Urbandale opposes this bill. Robinette says a permit is required in some cases when people assemble to speak in public and private places.
I have rights, too, as someone who doesn't carry a firearm, but I have the right to life and safety and happiness in Iowa.
Democratic Senator Tony Bisignano is part of the three-member subcommittee. Bisignano says regardless of the need to have a permit, he believes everyone who gets a gun should be required to have training.
You know, I don't feel good in a restaurant just because somebody next to me has a sidearm. If they've never taken a course, if they don't have any idea how to shoot, he becomes maybe more dangerous than the person coming in to rob the place who might have robbed eight other places before, and he's fired a weapon. I find him much more proficient. So I think training is something that we're pushing into the background is not necessary, when in fact, the more we put out into the marketplace weapons, the training is an important factor, and we need to take a look at that. I don't know what the law is going to be. Someone mentioned no one's gotten shot here in the Capitol. With no permit to carry, which is what our security does when you come through here, you have to show that you have a permit to carry. What is going to be the security in this building? I mean, I'd like to know that. I mean, do they not screen people anymore? If they screen you and you don't have a permit to carry, do they take your weapon? I don't know, and I'd like to know that, and I need to know these kinds of things before I make a determination on my support or opposition to this bill.
Republican Senator Jason Schultz says in areas like the Capitol, a person would still need a permit to carry.
You would still need a permit to carry in the Capitol. You would still need a permit if we got the school parking lot bill. I mean, this isn't in opposition, just to fill in that data point. You would still need a permit in order to pull into a school parking lot if we get that bill passed. So what I would reference as sensitive areas, places that the legislature is still kind of like, well, we're not quite ready there, you're still going to need a permit. If it says it now, you'll need it the day after the bill passes.
If an Iowan wants to take their handgun while traveling out of the state, they would have to have a gun permit. If they wish to purchase a gun from a federally licensed dealer, they'll also need a permit or pass a federal background check. The bill passes the subcommittee and will be further discussed in the full Senate Judiciary Committee. This is Under the Golden Dome from Iowa Public Radio, a weekly legislative podcast. I'm John Pimble. In the first 30 days of the session, the legislature is required to finalize funding for K-12 education. No matter how much the state provides, each of Iowa's 367 school districts is funded differently.
From the school finance perspective, Iowa's school funding formula is complicated.
Margaret Buckton is a lobbyist for the Rural School Advocates of Iowa and the Urban Education Network. They represent 17 districts, which contain 40% of Iowa students. The House is proposing a state education funding increase of 2.06%, but Buckton says
some folks think that means all school districts are going to get 2% more money, and that's not the way it works. With this proposal, we'll have 101 districts in Iowa that actually see budget reductions, and that is even taking into account that there will be 117 with that budget guarantee mechanism where they can tax their local property taxpayers for at least a 1% increase.
The reason some districts receive less than a 2% increase is due to enrollment.
And if they lose more students, if they lose more than 2.06% of their enrollment, and the per pupil amount goes up 2.06%, they're actually seeing less budget. And it accumulates over years. But what you find out is you don't have the whole second grade leave at the same time. So you may not be able to get rid of Mrs. Smith in the second grade class just because you have declining enrollment. It hits in different patches.
Section 1 sets the percent state of growth at 2.06.
Republican Representative Cecil Dolichek lays out how much more supplemental aid is in a bill during a House debate. Democratic Representative Roz Smith wants more and offers an amendment that would bring it to 3%.
What this amendment does is it puts us in a situation to fund our education at a level that's realistic and responsible.
It is $43 million more dollars than the Republican proposal.
This additional $43 million in spending would equate to $8.1 million increase for our teachers across the state.
It's Democratic Representative Molly Donahue's first term in the House. Donahue was a school teacher for 29 years and says over the past 8 years, Iowa's state funding has been devastating, especially for at-risk students.
We talk about wanting to increase programming and staff development for teachers with to help kids with mental illness and mental problems in their school day. But without the funding, we won't be able to provide that. And these are some of the most important and things that we can do for our kids. We need to be rebuilding after years of loss, but we can't do that. At 3%, we can at least stay even for where we've been.
The amendment for a 3% increase fails. The debate continues about funding levels, including talk about the last couple of years, when due to a shortfall in state revenue, the state aid increase to education was around 1%. Democratic Representative Bruce Hunter compares the average funding increases from the past two decades.
From 2000 to 2010, the average supplemental aid was 3.27%. And then a funny thing happened in 2011. The Democrats lost control of the House and the governorship. From 2011 to the present day, not including what we may or may not do today, the average state allowable growth has been 1.73%.
Democratic Representative Heather Mattson was just elected to her first term. She says as she campaigned, she heard public education funding was a priority.
At door after door, I heard everyday Iowans asking for a real investment in our schools. I ran not only for my own kids, but for every kid in this state. Public education is all about equal access to opportunity. And 2.06% simply doesn't cut it. Yes, this funding is more than it was last year. But I didn't come here to accept crumbs. I came to fight for our kids, what they deserve, and what they need.
Through the debate, 17 Democrats rise to speak for more funding. The only Republican to rise and speak is the bill's floor manager, Cecil Dolacek. In his closing remarks, he says he is glad this bill is being voted on within the first month of the session so districts can begin to make their budgets.
I realize school districts would like to have more. Our wants most often exceed our needs. Yeah, we want, you know, we'd like to have 3%. We could do this if we had, and this if we had 3%. But I think 2.306% adequately funds the needs out there.
Dolacek says this budget makes it pretty clear where the House's priorities are and where they will continue to be for the next several years. It passes the House, mostly along party lines, and moves to the Senate, where Democratic Senator Herman Kornbach argues for a 3% increase.
The last 2 years, the pitifully small increases in allowable growth, 1.1%, and then even worse, 1.0%, have not even begun to keep up with inflation. Inflation over those last 2 years has been 4.7%. So relative to inflation, we've actually cut the per pupil amount by 2.6%.
The floor manager, Republican Senator Amy Sinclair, says with a projected state revenue growth of 1.9%, education getting 2.06% is already a bit higher than the state can afford. Sinclair says if 3% is approved, there will be cuts in other departments.
It would mean that higher education or the troopers or public safety in general, the courts, conservation practices, one of those places would have to fill the gap because we simply are exceeding what we have available coming to us. I won't go into the history lesson for the new senators who have spoken about how we often overpromise and underdeliver on our funding levels. But when we do that, that actually harms school districts and property owners locally because they either have to cut staff or they have to go back and levy additional property taxes. We will not find ourselves in a place of overpromising and underdelivering, and 2.06 exceeds the state's estimated growth. It is a promise we can keep.
Senator Sinclair's voice is hoarse due to a cold lawmakers and state leaders seem to have this week. The supplemental state aid passes. Four Democrats side with Republicans voting for it, Senators Bisignano, Danielson, Kinney, and Mathis. Both chambers also pass a bill adding $7.8 million for transportation costs. It also increases per pupil spending by $2.3 million. With that, the overall percentage increase to K-12 education from the legislature is 2.3%. The total amount allocated is $3.3 billion. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature. I'm John Pimble. The Senate approved new ethics rules. One of them concerns sexual harassment. It states that a senator shall not harass any person, and accusations can be brought before an ethics board about incidents that occur at any point during a senator's time in office. That's a change from a 3-year statute of limitations. This does not include, however, allegations that took place before a person became a senator. The ethics rules also include a provision prohibiting senators from participating during debates on bills in which they have a conflict of interest. This weekly show always owes a special thanks to Iowa Public Radio Statehouse reporter Katarina Sestarik. Also thanks to the many reporters in the Statehouse press room and our talk show team members Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Kiefer. This week, Iowa Public Radio's news program director Catherine Perkins edited the script for this show. A new episode will be available next Friday and every Friday until April or May, when this half of the General Assembly ends. We publish it on iowapublicradio.org, and it shows up with most of the podcast subscription programs. I'm sure you are already using one. If not, subscribe to the show and anything else you see with Iowa Public Radio's name behind it. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.